Hello, everybody. Salman Asghari here. Welcome to Talk Iran. A lot has happened with Iran since I last released an episode, to say the least. The killing of Soleimani and the extremely tragic downing of Flight 752 and the loss of 176 innocent lives has been really hard to process for me and for Iranians and many other people in general. So my guest today, Afshan Ostovar, is actually just the right person to help us shed some light on what has happened in the past few weeks and provide some historical context, especially around the IRGC and who Qasem Soleimani was. Dr. Ostovar is an assistant professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. He was also a research scientist at the Center for Strategic Studies at CNA, a nonprofit research organization in the Washington, D.C. area. Previous to that, he was a fellow at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point and has also taught at Johns Hopkins University. Afshan is a foremost expert on the IRGC. His 2016 book, titled Vanguard of the Imam, Religion, Politics, and Iran's Revolutionary Guards, examines the rise of the IRGC, whose Quds force was led by Qasem Soleimani, and that organization's role in power politics, regional conflicts, and political violence. His commentary appears in Politico, Foreign Policy, Vox, The Guardian, and other popular media such as the New York Times, Reuters, Bloomberg, and NPR. Afshan and I cover a lot of ground. We start by talking about the historical context around the IRGC, when and how it was started, its role in the Iran-Iraq War, how the organization evolved through the years, how it's different than Iran's regular military, its Quds force and the Islamic Republic's foreign involvements, where Soleimani fit into the picture, his relationships with various Shia militia groups, and also other groups such as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, the mythology surrounding Soleimani and his role in ISIS's rise and fall. We also discuss the recent events surrounding Trump's decision to kill Soleimani, the legality of and the logic behind the killing, the downing of the Ukrainian jetliner and its implications on the survival of the Islamic Republic as a system, whether the system would have been strengthened as a result of Soleimani's killing if the downing of the jetliner hadn't happened, protests in Iran and their frequency, the possibility of an all-out collapse of the Islamic Republic, and other topics. So without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Afshan Ostovar. All right, so you wrote a book on the IRGC, or Sepah, and that gives me a lot to want to pick your brain on, including what has transpired in the last few weeks with the killing of Soleimani and the unfortunate downing of the airliner, and all of the implications surrounding those events. But let's flag that for now and start with the historical context around the IRGC, when and how it was established, how Soleimani fit into the picture, how it's different than Iran's regular military, and so on.
Right. Well, the IRGC was established sort of in the midst of the revolution in 79. It was sort of a way of bringing together all of the various militants and militias that supported Khomeini under one sort of organization, one umbrella, kind of unifying the sort of Islamic revolutionaries. And it very quickly sort of evolved into a military law enforcement organization, intelligence apparatus, all that supported the regime and Khomeini and everything else. Right after the revolution, it fought the Mujahideen al-Khalq and the Fedayi and the leftists, and it had those enemies. It was the first to deploy to fight Kurdish insurgents in Kurdistan. And then when the war started in 1980, it quickly took a frontline role and sort of proved itself to be willing to take, you know, really severe risks and to put its people sort of in harm's way and to enable them to sacrifice themselves for sort of the greater good of the war. And this earned them a lot of credibility and legitimacy within the regime. Through 1982, they, along with the regular military, sort of helped expel the Iraqi forces in 1982. And for the IRGC, a lot of the success they had was through what they called human wave attacks, which were basically just charging into the enemy and overwhelming them with sheer numbers.
So the IRGC was behind that. So you hear a lot about those human wave attacks, but so it was the IRGC that was...
Yeah, it was it was entirely the IRGC that led it. And then later in the war, they used the Basij, which were volunteers that were generally too young or too old to be in either the regular military or the IRGC, that's to say, to be a regular soldier. It was effective up until 1982. After 1982, when Iran decided to sort of push into Iraq and with the idea of overthrowing Saddam Hussein, they didn't have much success at all. And the human wave attacks were more like running into walls rather than sort of pushing the Iraqis back. It's what led to sort of the drastic numbers of Iranians killed. I mean, the stories were really horrific. They would, you know, send youngsters to clear minefields. They would send them without weapons. They would say, when you get across, find a weapon on the Iraqi side and turn it against them, that sort of thing. So the war really established the IRGC as a military that was sort of politically, you know, very well connected with the regime, very loyal to the supreme leader. But the military, the regular military, the Artesh, remained because they had capabilities that the IRGC didn't have, which was basically the logistics, all of the big machinery, tanks, sophisticated aircraft, all the stuff that essentially takes a lot of training. The regular military kept control over, and the IRGC sort of specialized in more ground forces and what we call sort of asymmetrical attacks, or basically sort of things that took less sophistication to pull off, but maybe not less sophistication in terms of sort of planning or whatever, but less sort of less technology and more sort of, I don't know, more human capacity.
Right. Did the IRGC ever compete with the regular military in terms of access to resources or whatever it may have been, or did they have a synergy going on, so to speak?
I mean, they competed quite strongly for resources. They competed politically as well. The IRGC was kind of the favorite son of the regime, and the Artesh was sort of seen, you know, the stepchild of the revolution. They were inherited from Pahlavis. And while they earned their respect during the war and were safe as an institution, they still never had the cred that the IRGC had. The IRGC, its whole sort of reason for being was to, as its name suggests in Persian, was to defend the regime, right? Defend the revolution, the Nizam.
The system.
The system, right. Velayat al-Faghi, this theocratic system that was established. The military just sort of was in charge of defending Iran's borders and territorial integrity. And so the IRGC had a much sort of deep-seated responsibility that enabled them and allowed them to sort of expand their influence all throughout the regime, because it was about defending the regime. So how do you defend the system, the revolution? You defend it, you know, militarily. You defend it in terms of intelligence, in terms of law enforcement, in terms of ideological and cultural production, propaganda. All of that stuff became sort of part of the IRGC's writ, whereas the Artesh stayed as a classic military. So they did compete, but I think their competition is often sort of overblown in analysis of the 80s and later on, because people see it as sort of this dividing line within the regime, right? You have sort of the quote-unquote secular military and the quote-unquote Islamic IRGC. One is pro-regime, one is pro-Iran, one is patriotic and nationalistic, the other is sort of religious. And that was really not the case at all. They competed for resources just like any militaries compete for resources. You know, within the United States, the Navy and the Marine Corps, which is within the Navy, but also the Army and the Air Force, they're always competing for resources. And I don't think it was all that different. It was much more politicized. That was different in the 80s. But in terms of, you mentioned the word synergy, there was a synergy towards the end of the war, and even in the middle of the war, in terms of fighting the war, operationalizing concepts, what, you know, sort of dividing what the military would do and what the IRGC would do. But the IRGC really took the lead. They were the lead force. Their commanders were sort of the most influential politically and in war fighting. So the war was largely theirs.
I see. And then after the war and after the death of Khomeini, their role and their place in the whole Iranian system sort of evolved, right? Can you explain how that happened?
Yeah, it happened in a number of ways. They were worried, actually, after the war, that they would be dissolved and merged with the regular military. They were afraid that Rafsanjani, who became president after the war, kind of had it out for them. But that didn't happen. But what did happen was a few different things. One thing Rafsanjani said, you guys need to learn how to pay for yourselves, right? You need to earn your keep. The state can't just fund you. Remember, Iran was basically broke after the war.
Right.
And so what they ended up allowing was for the IRGC to compete for state contracts. And the IRGC had a very had been developing an engineering arm during the war. And that became, in some sense, their subsidiary for bringing in state contracts. And very quickly, corruption and nepotism determined where these contracts went, the IRGC quickly outcompeted other people looking for state contracts. And so a lot of the rebuilding effort in Iran was gradually given to the IRGC. So they built, roads and dams and railways and different types of infrastructure, whatever. So this gave them a footprint or a foothold within the economy, which has steadily grown over time. They also got more involved in sort of the policing of morality within Iran through the Bastige. The Bastige was this huge mobilized organization that had no clear peacetime role, and so one of the things that they sort of allowed them to do was they licensed them as morality police. And so the people that would originally sort of shake down groups of youngsters at parks for bad hijab or for listening to music or for having the wrong hairstyles or or more serious offenses like drinking alcohol or whatever, that became sort of part of the IRGC's response or part of the IRGC's responsibility through the Bastige, which expanded. The other thing that happened was the IRGC had already developed a sort of network of relationships with groups outside of Iran, particularly in Lebanon with Hezbollah, but also in Afghanistan and other places. Mm-hmm. And after the war, they had Rafsanjani originally shut down the original sort of office that was in charge of that whole effort. That was called the Office of Liberation Movements. And instead, they stood up a new force called the Quds Force or the Jerusalem Force, which was charged with sort of working with Iran's clients and allies outside of Iran, sort of extraterritorial operations, foreign operations. And in the 90s, this didn't matter all that much. It continued Iran's relationships with Hezbollah. Iran got involved in the Balkans War in 92 through 95 and continued to sort of support groups in Afghanistan. But it was sort of a quiet time. With the exception of a series of terrorist attacks, it was relatively quiet for the IRGC in the 90s outside of Iran. Mm-hmm. But after 2001, 2003, with the toppling of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the Quds Force really sort of took on a new role by expanding Iran's influence in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And then later, during the Arab Spring, they expanded much more so into Syria and then into Yemen. So today, the Quds Force is in some ways the most important and most powerful division of the IRGC and is in many ways sort of takes the lead on Iranian foreign policy within the Middle East.
So where did Soleimani come into the picture?
So Soleimani got his start, like a lot of young folks in the war. He volunteered. He took part in the IRGC. He proved himself to be capable, and he continued to get promoted up. One of the things that happened within the IRGC was that commanders often sort of fought shoulder to shoulder with their soldiers, not in human wave attacks, but sort of at the front lines. They wouldn't sort of be in Tehran or sort of at a command post sort of behind the lines. They often were on the front lines. And so they took huge casualty rates. So commanders died left and right, which allowed, a lot of space for young people to sort of get promoted very quickly up the chain. And so by the end of the war, you had people like Soleimani who were, 27, 28 years old who were two decades ahead of where they would have been in terms of their authority in within the IRGC, in terms of the ranks that they had sort of achieved. By 97, he was put in charge of the Quds Force, and he really took to it and spent a lot of time developing personal connections with Iran's clients within Lebanon, in particular with Hassan Nasrallah and the leader of Hezbollah, and then also with the Iraqi groups that that Iran supported, which became, you know, essentially part of the Iraqi state after 2003. So Soleimani proved himself to be, you know, this really sort of savvy commander who was able to sort of create these relationships and this trust sort of network between Iran and its clients. And he also seemed to have, you know, a pretty sharp sense of strategy. And so he was able to take advantage of sort of the vacuums of power that happened in Afghanistan and in Iraq and swing them to Iran's advantage, essentially by, you know, supporting armed groups that generally fought against sort of the U.S. supported efforts within Iraq and Afghanistan.
So were his efforts limited to Shia groups, or did he have, because I've heard, for example, that he had helped the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in many ways and had kind of...
Right.
And what was his role in strengthening the Sunnis, in a sense?
It gets kind of confusing in some sense. You know, one thing that you learn, that I learned, let's say, you know, when I was in undergrad or whatever, is very simple things. You know, the Taliban are you know, Sunni fundamentalists. Iran are sort of Shia theocrats. You know, there's not going to be any sort of love lost between them. They're not going to support each other. So any rumor that you hear about that is going to be nonsense.
Right.
And that's easy to believe on the outside. And I still hear it sort of parried about. But what is harder to appreciate is that, you know, Iran is, you know, in many ways a realpolitik actor, right? It supports whoever is willing to work with it, frankly. You know, one thing to understand about the Islamic Republic is that it has virtually no friends in the world. Right. Its only real ally that's a state is Syria, which is, you know, basically a failed state right now, occupied by Russia, Iran, in some respects, Turkey, you know, the United States has forces there. So it's not a functioning state. You know, it gets support from Russia and China, but this is more because for Russia and China, Iran is sort of a convenient partner because of its because of Iran's hostile relations with the United States. Right.
Right.
So what Iran, instead of having sort of state allies, it has developed allies among armed groups that it supports. Right. And these are groups that are allied with Iran, partly out of ideological affinity or shared religious identity, but mostly because Iran gives them money and weapons that they wouldn't get otherwise, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Iran tends to support the groups that don't get support from anybody else, right? That don't have a competitor as a patron.
And may not necessarily be aligned with them ideologically.
Yeah. Part of the reason why these groups do align with Iran, generally speaking, is because they're Shia, and there's no other sort of Shia state that is, you know, that's out there that has in no other Sunni state that's interested in sort of having Shia clients, right? So Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Iraqi groups, to a lesser extent, the Alawites in Syria, etc., the Houthis in Yemen, all of them are on sort of the Shia side of the spectrum, and none of them have a good sort of support base outside of Iran. But Iran is willing to work with, frankly, anybody, right? Anybody that shares, you know, a sort of political or ideological alignment with Iran, which basically means being anti-American, right?
Right.
In terms of foreign policy, at least. Anti-Israel, even better. So, you know, it'll work with Venezuela. You know, it will work with Cuba. It will work with North Korea. It'll work with secular atheist regimes, so long as they sort of share the same sort of politics. But the relationships with those countries only get so close. Where Iran has sort of stepped in to support Sunnis has been with Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, both in Gaza, because neither get support, at least not the type of support that they want from Sunni states anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They've long had sort of allies within Afghanistan, particularly Persian-speaking Tajiks, which they've supported throughout the 90s and you know, through the present day. But then, you know, they also have developed relationships with groups that are anti-American and are willing to fight the United States, and therefore are sort of convenient partners that have overlapping interests, right? And that's where the Taliban fits in. So Iran almost went to war with the Taliban in 1998, right, after the Taliban killed some Iranian diplomats, Mazar-e Sharif. But, you know, after 2001, with the U.S. sort of occupation of Afghanistan, and then with Iraq, and with sort of tense relations with the United States, Iran sort of made peace with the Taliban and saw the Taliban as a useful way of sort of harassing and undermining sort of U.S. interests in Afghanistan. And so they started supporting the Taliban basically by shipping weapons, EFPs, sort of make up sort of the bulk of roadside bombs that can sort of penetrate armored vehicles and are quite lethal.
Mm-hmm.
And providing some training and other things. And then Al-Qaeda is a little more complicated. A lot of Al-Qaeda members and their families left Afghanistan in 2001 with the U.S. invasion. And Iran arrested most of them. They escaped to Iran. Iran arrested most of them, put them in a variety of sort of detention centers, some of which were like jails, some of which were like apartments in Tehran. You know, they were sort of under house arrest. And Iran at times has sort of flipped some of these Al-Qaeda members to be sort of assets for the IRGC. And it's not entirely clear how much Iran collaborates with them on operations, but what seems to be the relationship is that they allow Al-Qaeda to do what it does so long as it doesn't do it against Iran or Iran's allies. You know, so smuggling people across Iran, smuggling money, that sort of thing seems to be what Iran has helped facilitate with Al-Qaeda. But again, Al-Qaeda, you know, comes from a Salafi jihadi background, which is, you know, quite Sunni and generally, you know, very anti-Shia. It's not a natural pairing at all, neither for Al-Qaeda nor for Iran. But there's some sort of, you know, strategic or operational overlap, which allows them to work together.
Interesting. Let's get back to Soleimani. So was he really this extremely influential, charismatic figure, or was some of that manufactured by the Islamic Republic as propaganda? Because a lot of people say, hey, he wasn't really this kind of figure that we give him credit for. What's the reality there?
Well, both. he really was charismatic. He really was influential. He really did have very close relations with Iran's proxies and clients, and seems to have been very well trusted and very well sort of loved by the people who worked with him. And there's no reason to doubt that his influence was genuine. You know, he certainly had a very profound influence on Iranian foreign policy in the Middle East, and probably was, you know, the most important person outside of the supreme leader in terms of determining policy for places like Iraq or Syria or Lebanon or Yemen, and perhaps strategic policy versus, you know, Saudi Arabia or the United States or Israel. So all that, I think, is generally true. I think what gets exaggerated was his strategic acumen, his operational acumen. This idea that he was sort of this genius military leader is overblown, and certainly was promoted and manufactured by in part by the Islamic Republic, but also in part by Western journalists who really bought into this idea of the shadow commander who, you know, secretly controlled, you know, all of these very powerful militias that the United States, you know, just couldn't defeat and had outsmarted America at every turn. Soleimani was certainly savvy. He was able to sort of exploit the vacuums in Iraq and Afghanistan, Iraq especially, but also Syria and expand Iran's influence in Yemen as well. But the main place that he had sort of the most influence was in Iraq. And in Iraq, you know, the Shia militias were in part what drove the United States out of Iraq in 2011. They killed, you know, hundreds of Americans. They were you know, the worst enemy of the Americans after the jihadists, and really became more powerful by the end than the jihadists. And that was largely orchestrated by Soleimani. And so Soleimani, in some sense, was responsible for driving out the United States in 2011. The problem is, and this is where sort of the mythology of Soleimani really takes a huge hit, is that Soleimani's sort of what Soleimani did with all that power in with the departure of the United States when Iran became sort of the most influential power in Iraq after 2011, is he sort of trusted and supported his allies to sort of take control of the country and to run it precisely how they wanted to run it. And that led to the rise of ISIS almost directly. The sectarian and abusive policies of the Maliki administration, which completely alienated the Sunnis and paved the way for sort of the rise of extremism, or the return of extremism, and certainly the sympathy for extremists. And then ultimately, you know, helping sort of develop Iraq's military forces with appointments that were largely sort of based on patronage rather than sort of ability, you know, led to the collapse of the Iraqi military when ISIS steamrolled into Mosul. And so when ISIS very quickly took over half of Iraq, the adventure that Soleimani had, you know, led Iraq through had been exposed as quite shallow and certainly not in any way genius, right? You know, he had led sort of Iraq into a disaster. And that's when, at sort of his low point, the Islamic Republic begins to build up the legend of Soleimani. That's when you suddenly have all these pictures coming out of the front lines of Soleimani, you know, drinking chai with the Iraqis, saying namaz with the same prayers with the Iraqis, being on the front lines with the Iraqis, you know, being there with the troops fighting ISIS. You know, I continue to hear to this day that Soleimani was, you know, ISIS's number one enemy and you know, perhaps the most important sort of element in defeating ISIS. And that's just frankly not true. But it is true in terms of how Iran and the Islamic Republic tried to build up his brand. It's certainly part of his brand.
So they did that to divert attention from the fact that some of Soleimani's activities were actually the cause of ISIS's rise, and to kind of give the impression that Soleimani and Iran in general is anti-ISIS, and which it was, and is fighting ISIS on the front lines. So ultimately, what ended up being Soleimani's role in all the defeat of ISIS, if you can argue that ISIS was defeated?
Yeah, I mean, he certainly became involved. I mean, there's no doubt that he played a role. There's no doubt that the Iraqi militias, which he, you know, was sort of the de facto leader, played a huge role. They lost a lot of people. They fought a lot of battles. There's no doubt that they sacrificed and played a significant role in combating ISIS. But ISIS would have never been defeated. They never would have made ground against ISIS had the Iraqis, the Iraqi government, not asked the United States to return to Iraq. It was the United States military power, particularly its air power, that is to say its ability to sort of drop bombs on targets from the sky, that paved the way for defeating ISIS, right? It's what allowed sort of the Hashda Shabi, the Iraqi militias, as well as the Iraqi security forces, to make gains on the ground, was sort of softening the targets from the sky. And that's a capability that Iran just frankly just doesn't have. And they wouldn't have, you know, been able to sort of make much headway against ISIS had that not happened. So ironically, you know, Soleimani was the person who kicked out the United States in 2011, but was also indirectly responsible for the United States' return to Iraq just a few years later. this to me, I think, is sort of, you know, speaks to Soleimani's legacy. So he was involved, but it was really the Iraqi security forces, the Peshmerga, and the United States that really were, I think, far more influential in the defeat of ISIS, or the territorial defeat of ISIS in Iraq. And then if you look at Syria, Iran was and its allies were basically starting to lose gradually ground against the rebellion. And it wasn't until the Russians' intervention into Syria, which brought that same capability, air power, that the Assad regime began to sort of turn the tide against the rebellion, which has continued. So a lot of what is attributed to Soleimani in terms of his, you know, sort of his military genius is actually the direct result of American and Russian military power, and really has nothing to do with Soleimani.
I see. Let's fast forward a little bit and talk about the recent events. Obviously, Iran and the U.S. have a very complicated relationship that goes back decades. But sort of what led to what's happened recently, the way I see it, was the pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal by Donald Trump that happened in 2018. That's when a lot of tit for tat started. And there were a bunch of events in 2019 in particular, with Iran attacking the Saudi oil fields and the tankers, and the U.S. Sort of threatening Iran and going back and forth in that sense. The more immediate events that started on with the rocket attack on a military base in Kirkuk by Kataib Hezbollah on December 27th of 2019, that attack killed an American contractor, wounded several American service members. Then the U.S. responded by attacking various Kataib Hezbollah sites in Syria and Iraq, which then led to protesters storming the U.S. embassy in Iraq. And the U.S. obviously blamed Iran for all of this when it was happening. And all of that ultimately led to the drone strike by Donald Trump on January 3rd that killed Soleimani at Baghdad airport. Was the killing of Soleimani in line with Trump's bigger strategy on Iran? Or was it strictly an impulsive, politically self-serving act without any clear game plan behind it, as many people have suggested? Obviously, people have argued that Soleimani, you know, was a bad man who killed a lot of people. The world is a better place without him. What I'm trying to understand is if there was any sort of a wise, longer-term strategic rationale or logic, however twisted, behind the drone strike by Trump. More importantly, was this legal?
Well, to both your questions, I don't know. I don't know what the Trump administration was intending. I mean, obviously, their statements, you know, have come out. Some of them have been somewhat contradictory. And the legality issue, you know, I've read pieces that said it was illegal. I've read pieces that said it was a legal gray area. To me, a lawyer could sort of answer that you know, more accurately than I could. Sure. But what I would say is that it is a symptom of ongoing U.S.-Iranian tensions, and sort of the almost intractable situation that the United States and Iran have found themselves to be in, right? So, you know, we can go back to any point in time and say this was the beginning, right? I mean, obviously, the Trump administration pulling out of the JCPOA kicked off, you know, what's happened over the last few years, and particularly what's happened in 2019. It was the reimposition of sanctions that Iran is, you know, trying to is responding to, and is trying to, you know, in some sense get the United States to reverse. The challenge for the Islamic Republic is that they have very limited parameters set by the supreme leader in terms of how they can compel the United States to change its mind on sanctions. They're not allowed to talk. They're not allowed to compromise, which leaves them what? right? It leaves them only actions, only behavior, only things that they do that can be seen and interpreted as stimuli to sort of induce the United States to decide to change its mind. What the Islamic Republic, I think, doesn't realize is that while sanctions might be terrible for Iranian society and for Iranian civilians, and certainly, you know, are severely damaging to the Iranian economy, for the United States, they take almost no effort. It's particularly for this administration, which seems less worried about U.S. allies, you know, disagreeing with U.S. policy, right? So lots of U.S. allies disagree with sanctions and with pulling out of the JCPOA. But the Trump administration doesn't seem to be much moved by you know, what the French or the British or the Germans have to say about any of this, and much less about what the Chinese or the Russians might have to say about it. If the Islamic Republic understands the Trump administration correctly, what they should understand is that this is a small issue for the Trump administration that they feel like they have a lot of political support for in terms of their supporters, and is quite, you know, in some ways painless for them to sort of for them to keep up. Right. So in order for the Islamic Republic to compel the United States to sort of change its mind, without speaking to the United States and without compromising with the United States, it basically has to convince the United States that pursuing this policy is no longer in U.S. interest, right? And that is by leading the U.S. into a conflagration or a conflict, which they seem to believe that the Trump administration doesn't want, right? So to get back to your question about what the Trump administration is trying to achieve, it's somewhat unclear, but if you take the president at his word, more often than not, he has said things like, I just want to sit down with the Iranians and get a better deal, right?
Right.
And judging from how he's dealt with North Korea, I think you sort of need to take him at his word in that regard and realize that much of Trump administration policy seems to be driven by sort of undoing Obama era policy, right? But not to the extent of trying to do the opposite of what the Obama administration did, but rather just doing something different than what the Obama administration did and delinking a policy from the Obama administration and rebranding it as a better, stronger policy done by the Trump administration. That's how I read the Trump administration, at least. And so what I believe the Trump administration wants is just to sit down with Iran, or what the president wants is just to sit down with Iran and hash out a deal. Now, the Trump administration, through Secretary Pompeo, gave a list of demands of what they expect Iran to compromise on. And Brian Hook, the State Department official, sort of reiterated that in a slightly truncated form just recently, within the last week or so. Pompeo's list was, I think, 12 things. I think Hook's list was 5 things. But basically, they can be clumped into, 3 or 4 main categories, right?
Right.
Number one is the nuclear issue. Okay, they don't want Iran to enrich uranium. Second is ballistic missiles. They don't want Iran to have a ballistic missile program. Why is that? Well, Iran just proved that they can hit targets very accurately over the horizon from Iran within Iraq or other places and do significant damage, right? So Iran has sort of, in some ways, by attacking the base, Ain al-Assad base in Iraq just a few weeks ago, sort of made the case for their ballistic missiles even more important because they proved that they really are a significant military capability. So that's another issue. Third is what is sometimes called Iran's regional aggression, destabilizing activities, or its malign behavior in foreign countries. It's given various names. But this basically is Iran's support for groups outside of its borders, for militant groups outside of its borders. And what the core of that is Iran's support for groups that are at war with Israel, Hezbollah in particular, but also Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Those are that's the real sort of, I think, crux of the problem between the United States and Iran.
How far is Iran willing to compromise on each one?
Well, right now, not a millimeter on any of them, So people on the outside, analysts will say, well, this is a non-starter. This is maximalist, this is sort of a maximalist demand from the Trump administration. Iran will never go for it. It's just a waste of time to even suggest it. And I think there's truth in that, right? Iran likely isn't going to go for it. But I think of these three buckets, one of them, I think, is a real legitimate ask, right? So Iran gains a lot from its support for groups outside of Iran, in Lebanon and elsewhere, particularly because it can use these groups, which are all militaries, essentially. We call them militias or terrorist groups, but they're frankly militaries. They're very powerful. They're sophisticated. All of these groups can target Iran's enemies, Israel primarily. Hezbollah can target Israel with its own missiles and rockets, which Iran supplies to Hezbollah. It's a real sort of significant danger for Israel. Hamas obviously has an indigenous sort of rocket capability, as well as Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And the Iraqi groups that are in Syria have also, some of them have also sort of promised to sort of target Israel in the future. And then the Iraqi groups in Iraq obviously have targeted American forces in the past and up until and continue to do it weekly almost with rocket attacks toward, near the embassy or at military bases. And then you have the Houthis in Yemen who have launched, ballistic missiles, Scuds, at Saudi Arabia and have done some significant damage with them, right? So asking Iran to no longer provide, rockets or missile technology to these groups and to no longer provide them weapons, I think is, a legitimate ask, right? And it's something that, that Iran, frankly, will need to do if it ever wants to have peace and security, right? If the Islamic Republic truly wants to be secure and to be stable and for their system, their Nizam to be no longer targeted by enemies, they're going to have to no longer be at war with other states in the region. That's my take or my thinking of it. The Islamic Republic sees it the opposite, right? That if they give up these relationships, they'll be sort of giving up their most significant deterrent, right? That their ability to strike Israel, for example, is what keeps the United States from going to war with Iran. Remember the ballistic missile strike that just happened a couple weeks ago in Iraq. Iran followed that up by saying, if the United States responds, we are going to target Dubai and Haifa, right? The UAE and Israel. And, after launching ballistic missiles at U.S. military, at a military base housing U.S. forces, you have to take Iran at its word, right? That it's willing to do that. I don't know if that's why the United States didn't respond to the missile attack or not, but certainly you can imagine that it's something that we had to think about. It's something that Israel and the UAE had to think about and probably, had conversations with the United States in real time about that possibility, right? So Iran has a real reason to not want to give up those relationships, but it's those relationships which have kept the Islamic Republic alienated and marginalized for 40 years. It's what keeps the United States so invested in the Middle East. What I think is the biggest irony is that the IRGC and the Islamic Republic both say that their primary goal in everything that they do is to expel the United States from the Middle East. And it's everything that they do that keeps the United States in the Middle East.
Fascinating. You touched on the Islamic Republic's survival. Let's talk about that a little bit. Their resilience has been astounding through the years. They've really been able to rally the populace through the years, stave off any serious threats to its existence. But many argue, well, people have always argued when there were protests during the past 40 years, this is the time, the tides are turning in a major way. But judging from, the past four decades, Is it conceivable to think that the tides are turning now, given, you know, the government's admission that they shot down the Ukrainian airliner? Or is this just another blip? And if the downing of the airliner hadn't happened, could they have been strengthened by the Soleimani situation and in terms of the various factions in the region sort of uniting and against the United States, pushing the U.S. out ultimately and consolidating Iran's power?
Well, it's obviously difficult to say, right? You know as well as I do that Iranians, you know, champion a lot of different views, and Iranians, just like any population, are emotional, right? And so the way that I've always talked about the Islamic Republic is, for people who live in Iran or still consider Iran home, is that it's like a relative, you know? You can say whatever you want about your own relatives, right? But right. The moment that somebody else criticizes your relative, you know, the gloves come off, right? You can't say anything about you know, my uncle or my aunt or whatever. You know, so you see this all the time in talking with people in Iran, you know, depending the mood that they're in, things are either sort of, you know, worse and can't get any better. They've never been so bad. Or frankly, they're not bad. You know, everything is exaggerated. We're doing just fine here. Thank you very much. Kind of attitude. So, you know, what do you do in moments that like this, that are crisis moments and that are so sort of emotionally and politically powerful? And, you know, so that almost everybody has to have an opinion on them. Right. So, you know, the martyrdom of Soleimani or the assassination of Soleimani, however you want to view it, I think was quite powerful, you know, and I think did lead to some sympathetic feelings within Iranian society broadly that I think are complicated and not as simplistic as people actually cared about Soleimani. I think there was just something personal in it, right? That's hard to sort of that's hard to describe. But I think people sort of felt in some ways personally attacked by the assassination, even if they, you know, couldn't have given, you know, two pinches of salt for Soleimani. At that moment, there was something personal about it. But I think there's something even far more personal about the downing of Flight 752 and the fact that the regime both did it and, you know, in some ways, even if they lied for 3 days about it, you know, at least they admitted to it eventually. I think any sort of sympathy for, you know, the aggression against Iran through the assassination of Soleimani for most people was completely overshadowed and eclipsed by the downing of the flight, right? And I think it brought back for a lot of people that just this the sheer amount of injustice that the regime is capable of on almost a daily basis, right? Yeah. And the fact that the regime follows it up with not sort of condolences and support for the aggrieved, but just more indignities, banning people from funerals, making funerals photo ops for Basijis that attend them, you know, but barring the family from attending them, you know, trying to argue with Canada to not repatriate bodies to Canada, saying that they're all, you know, Iranian citizens because they don't recognize dual citizenship. You don't know where any of these things are going. I think the regime kind of cannot help itself, right? Its true colors are to use coercion against the populace in order to prevent any uprisings or public discontentment, right? You have to remember the regime is still run by the first generation of revolutionaries, right? It's still the same guys that marched in Tehran in 78 and 79 that lead this thing. And even though they're slowly dying off, they're still in charge. And they know what it takes to overthrow a regime. Yeah. They know the mistakes that the Shah made. They know what they were able to capitalize on. And they're doing everything in their power to not allow themselves to make those mistakes. And one thing that they've learned is, frankly, the Iranians have not much appetite for being killed and being tortured in jail, right? So yeah. If you protest and you know that you have a likelihood of being killed or being thrown in jail and tortured, that's a real disincentive for most people, you know?
Isn't a segment of the population reaching that threshold? Because, I mean, if you think about it, the Iranian economy is contracted by 10% last year, and I think it's on pace to contract just as much this year. More people are going into poverty by the day. I mean, there must be a point that can be reached where people are just willing to die en masse. They don't care. They have nothing to lose, right?
I mean, there are certainly people in Iran that have reached that point. I don't think you have the masses that have reached that point. At least not, we don't see it yet, right? Like, so like the protest that happened in the fall of 2019, you know, these protests happen in places that you wouldn't expect protests to happen, right? I mean, Khuzestan was the epicenter of it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Mashhad, Dezful, like, these are not towns that you expect anti-regime activity en masse, right?
Right.
This is where the IRGC, you know, gets many of its strongest supporters and commanders. They come from the provinces, particularly in the south, from Kerman and Khuzestan in particular, also from Esfahan province. You know, it's the provincials that are the strongest, you know, supporters of the regime, or at least they had been. But I think what you're seeing now is this generational shift, right? And it's hard to know whether this is episodic or whether this is sort of snowballing. If you sort of step back for a moment, and it's hard not to see this pattern whether it is a pattern or whether it's just a coincidence, I don't know. But if you look at it and say, okay, when were the, after the war, because the war was sort of, you know, sort of sui generis. It was difficult to sort of have a popular movement during the war. But after the war, you've had three major disruptions in terms of popular protests of various sizes, mm-hmm. right? The first was 1999, the university protests, particularly in Tehran. The second was in 2009, the election protests. Mm-hmm. And the third was in 2019. And if you want to include 2018, January of 2018, you can. But that's, you know, this idea of sort of protest every 10 years, you know, we'll see how long that lasts. But to me, that's kind of interesting, particularly as a historian, it's kind of interesting to look at. And the way that I've looked at it, and this could be completely incorrect, but the way that I've looked at it is that these are essentially generational protests. Mm-hmm. You know, 1999 was the Generation X protest. 2009 was sort of the millennials, the older millennials protesting, and 2019 was sort of the young millennials and sort of the Generation Z protests, right? But what you're not seeing after 1999 and 2009, and we don't know what we'll see after 2019 into 2020, is how much people are willing to continue to protest, right? Mm. After the protests were crushed in 1999, you didn't really see much demonstrations until 2009. 2009 was much larger, went on much longer. It was also, you know, the way that they put it down was much more brutal in the end. But you had almost a decade of relative quiet in terms of anti-regime protests.
But if you clustered 2018, 2019, and then the recent, just what's been happening, because there were protests, what, in January of 2018, and then
right.
November of 2019, and then obviously in January of 2020, if you clustered that together, doesn't it look like they're getting more frequent?
It does. Certainly, right? And what we have to remember about the 2018 protests was that these protests started as hardliners instigating economic protests against the Rouhani administration that snowballed out of their control and became anti-regime protests. And again, were happening in places that you didn't generally, you know, think you would have protests, right? They were happening in smaller and medium town provincial cities. So yeah, I do think people are getting more desperate, but I also think it's the younger people that are feeling more desperate, right? I think the challenge for protesting is that once you have a spouse and a child, protesting becomes really difficult to do, right? And right, so right. From my perspective, it's a young person's business. You either have to be too old or too young to care. Once you have something to lose, your responsibilities go elsewhere. You become more selfish, more self-centered. And I don't mean selfish in a bad way. I just mean, you know, you feel like you need to take care of your own first.
Unless your child's hungry, then, you know.
Unless your child's hungry, yeah. Or, you know, as what's happening with people these days, you know, you're not able to get married, right? Because you're not able to move out of the house. You can't afford a dowry in an apartment, et cetera. I do think people seem to be getting more frustrated with what's going on and more desperate. The difficult thing is to know, how do they continue to do this in the face of basically a militarized response? In Mashhad, like, you had tanks, you know, surrounding protesters, right? I mean, they charged them into marshes and lit the marshes on fire. They, you know, they machine gunned people in the water. Like, this was not 2009. This isn't Basijis with baseball bats and chains and, you know, the odd guy with a handgun. This was a military crackdown. I think the IRGC and the regime feel like they're willing to go as severe as they need to go in order to sort of put people back in their houses. And I think that's the real challenge, right? Is to know, you know, to actually disrupt society to the extent that you overturn the system is not easy to do. That's not to say it can't happen tomorrow. It can.
Yeah.
But I think the Islamic Republic is stronger than the Pahlavi regime was in terms of its hold on society. And I think it would be more difficult for it to be overthrown in a revolution. But I think what's happening, and I think this gets to sort of the point that you're trying to make, is that with each subsequent generation, you are having sort of a distance from all of those signposts of the past, all of those issues of the past that were in the minds and experiences of the older generations that made the Islamic Republic what it is, right? That is to say, you have people that don't remember the Pahlavi regime, that don't remember the injustice of Savak, right? Don't remember people being disappeared or being afraid to talk about politics with your family members or with your friends, thinking that everybody could be a snitch.
Mm-hmm.
They don't remember the Iran-Iraq war and what that felt like for missiles to be, you know, to be taking out apartment buildings in Tehran and what it was like to sort of live under that. They don't even remember the 90s, right? And maybe even the hope that Khatami brought for a brief period, in the idea that maybe the Islamic Republic can reform itself and be sort of okay in the world. They don't remember any of that. You know, all that they understand now is basically the crap that they've had to deal with in the 21st century. And that's included sanctions. That's included, really severe tensions with the United States. That's included sort of wars on either side of their border. That's included sort of watching Syria and Iraq and Yemen sort of devolve into failed states, the rise of ISIS, all of this kind of stuff. But any sort of reason for the Islamic Republic's legitimacy, I think, is completely lost on the youngest generation. You know, what is the Islamic Republic's claim other than they're the ones that make the rules?
Yeah, but I just can't formulate an all-out collapse of the system in my head just because of the reasons that you just talked about. What would happen to all of these armed Basijis and IRGC people and who would fill the vacuum? It's just an all-out collapse almost seems inconceivable. And but maybe it's not. I don't know. I mean, a lot of people argue that during the Arab Spring, if you went to any one of those countries like Tunisia or wherever else and asked people if they think, you know, 2 months before the government collapsed, if you asked them if they think the government's going to collapse, they would think it's inconceivable as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I mean, history should make us all humble in our opinions. I mean, you know, I always preface anything about the future or whatever with I don't know. I mean, that's
right.
That's the truth of the matter is I have no idea what the future holds. You know, the regime could collapse tomorrow. It could last for another 200 years. It could be completely different in 50 years. You know, it could be like the Communist Party of China. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know. But what I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's an inevitable generational shift that's happening. And at some point, that first generation won't be in charge anymore. And what that second generation looks like, or the third generation looks like, and how they sort of understand the Islamic Republic and what they want it to be, should it last that long, I think is anybody's guess. You know, it could be like Cuba, it could be like North Korea, it could be like China, or it could be completely different, you know. I don't know, but I do know that Iranian society is dynamic, and that the Islamic Republic has not, after 40 years, convinced, I think, the majority of Iranians that it frankly is a good steward of Iran in the world.
Yeah. Well, Afshan, this was really fascinating. Thank you. I know your knowledge and expertise is in high demand right now, especially given the recent events. And for you to carve out some time for me and the podcast is highly appreciated. So thanks.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I wish it was a more uplifting conversation, but you know, these are the things that are going on. So it's good to talk about them.
All right. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode. If you did, please share it with your family and friends and put it out on social media. If you really enjoyed the episode, please review the podcast on iTunes or any of the other platforms. You may also follow me on Facebook and Twitter using the handle @TalkIran1. If you have any feedback or guest recommendations, you may email me at info@talkiran.org. Once again, thanks for listening and stay tuned for a lot more great guests coming up. And until the next episode, take care.